It is Wednesday, February 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Coming up, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson admits the U.S. is partly responsible for South America's drug trade. House Democrats and President Donald Trump in a standoff over another classified memo about Russia. And hopes run high about possible talks between North and South Korea, as do doubts.
I think this is a distraction. I think this is doing what North Korea has always done, which is when things get hot, start talking.
It's all ahead in this next half hour. Beginning today, U.S. stocks opened sharply lower on Tuesday on the heels of sell-offs earlier in the day in Asia and Europe, and just one day after the Dow Jones Industrial Average shed the most points in one day in its more than 120-year history. On Tuesday, U.S. markets closed up higher, but not after sending jitters through global markets. For example, earlier Tuesday, Asia's benchmark stock indexes collapsed as Monday's massive sell-offs on Wall Street rolled across the globe. Before the U.S. market rebounded at the close, Asian markets were caught in the ripple effect of Monday's 1,175-point loss on the Dow, marking the biggest point decline in history. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Jacob Kierkegaard, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Jacob, thanks for being with us. Tell us about this ripple effect and why Asian markets are so affected by what happens here in the United States.
Well, I mean, the United States stock markets have traditionally been the bellwether for global stock markets. This isn't just an Asia phenomenon. We saw exactly the same play out in the European markets. It basically reflects the fact that the United States stock market is the most liquid in the world, and of course the general dominance or importance of the U.S. economy in the global economy.
When the Dow lost 666 points, that drop followed a solid jobs report. It showed the U.S. economy adding 200,000 jobs, wages rising at the fastest pace in the decade. Why has such seemingly positive news led to such negative movement in the markets?
This is the key part. I mean, this is good news. The fact that the average American worker is finally taking home approximately almost 3% higher wages is really good news. But it also means that combined with the recent very significant tax cuts passed by Congress, that there is, in the views of many market participants, now a risk of overheating in the U.S. economy and therefore inflation, therefore higher interest rates, both in the long end of the yield curve, but also from the Federal Reserve, ultimately leading to a repricing of the stock market. But it is ironic that good news leads to a bad stock market outcome.
And that's nothing new, right?
No, I mean, this is a normal phenomenon, although I will say that it has become significantly more pronounced since the Great Recession. We may finally be on the cusp of leaving that state, which we had been in pretty much since the end of the recession in 2009.
Is this a stock market correction as far as you're concerned?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think we have had a significant run-up in the markets. We've had a lot of record closes over the course of the last 2 or 3 months. But it doesn't change the fact that overall the U.S. economy is producing close to full, it is at full employment. It's close to capacity, if not at capacity. So the real economy is quite strong. You would expect, combined with a sort of strongly synchronized global upswing, which we're seeing around the world, that the U.S. stock market would be doing well. But perhaps in the eyes of some market participants, with the significant tax cuts coming on top of all this good news, that, you know, we may be in for a bit of a sugar high.
In your opinion, has this phase of volatility come to an end after a couple of days?
No, I mean, I'm actually of the opinion that this kind of volatility will continue for quite some time because, you know, there is a real risk, in my opinion, that inflation will pick up in the United States quite significantly, something that will lead to potentially significantly higher interest rates. And this undoubtedly will be quite painful for a lot of firms and a lot of individuals that may or may not have taken on a lot of debt during the last decade, where, of course, interest rates have been close to zero, so they haven't felt much of an interest rate burden. But those days may also be over, and therefore, repricings are in my opinion, necessary in that scenario, and it's a real risk. And that risk isn't going to disappear just because we may regain most of what the market lost yesterday.
Do you predict this is a worldwide phenomenon, around the world, everything continuing like this?
I think it is the volatility of the stock market, I think, will actually be more of an American phenomenon, because the reality is that the U.S. stock market is more aggressively or higher priced relative to corporate earnings than stock markets in other parts of the world. Therefore, the U.S. stock market valuation is more at risk for this type of repricing. But it doesn't change the fact that if you have a very volatile or violent swing or significant in-day decline, that effect will be felt around the world, no doubt about that.
Jacob Kierkegaard is Senior Fellow at the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics. Jacob, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jacob Kierkegaard of the Peterson Institute speaking with our own Ira Melman. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is visiting Colombia to push for the implementation of the peace agreement and measures to curb illegal drug production. In Peru on Tuesday, Tillerson acknowledged that the United States is part of the drug problem because its huge demand for opioids make it an attractive market for smugglers. Tillerson defended the U.S. trade policy, saying bilateral trade agreements work to the U.S. advantage better than some regional agreements. VOA's Zlatica Hoke has more.
Tillerson's South America tour is focused on the political crisis in Venezuela and the possibility of sanctioning the country's oil industry as part of the pressure on its autocratic leader Nicolas Maduro to return to democracy. In Peru, Tillerson praised the efforts of the so-called Lima Group of 12 Latin American countries mediating in Venezuela.
Our governments appreciate Peru's leadership of the Lima Group in an effort to bring some reconciliation between the Maduro regime, encouraging the regime to return to its constitution and allow the people of Venezuela's voice to be heard in the selection of their leaders.
The U.S. top diplomat said the United States has not entirely rejected the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between several nations in Asia and the Americas, including Peru, but praised the value of bilateral agreements for the United States.
So the 20 free trade agreements the United States has globally, 12 of them are in this hemisphere. So we have very strong trading agreements already in place.
In Colombia, Tillerson is urging the government to discourage the cultivation of coca and encourage Colombian farmers to grow other crops for a sustainable living. Speaking to reporters in Peru Monday, he acknowledged the role of the United States in the illegal drug trade.
And, you know, we are the largest consumer of illicit drugs, and so we have to begin to work on that problem. And President Trump has recognized it. And he has put an initiative forward on drug demand reduction, ready to put $1 billion behind that effort to reduce the demand for drugs among the American people as well, because of the devastating impact it's having.
Tillerson commended the agenda set for the Summit of Americas in Peru in April, which includes tackling crime and corruption. He said the U.S. president has not yet decided if he will attend. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back. You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. I'm Doug Bernard. The United Nations is calling for an immediate ceasefire in Syria to allow for the delivery of life-saving aid to millions of civilians who are without food, medicine, or other essential needs. Lisa Schlein has more in this report from Geneva.
The United Nations says it needs at least a one-month humanitarian pause in the fighting throughout Syria to organize the delivery of aid and services and to evacuate critically ill and wounded people from besieged and hard-to-reach areas. Aid workers warn people in certain parts of the country are at particular risk and need to be reached with humanitarian aid immediately. One area is eastern Ghouta, a suburb of the capital, Damascus. The city's 400,000 residents have had no delivery of food and other relief supplies for more than 2 months. In addition, the UN reports hundreds of critically ill and wounded people, including children, are still waiting to be evacuated from the city so they can receive medical care. A spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says about 2 million people living in the governorate of Idlib are living in a particularly perilous state.
There are hundreds of thousands of people who are internally displaced there, on the run, extremely vulnerable, and they come under attack and under bombardment. That is completely unacceptable. So all these things taken together has prompted the UN team in Damascus to come up and say enough is enough. Now we need a humanitarian pause because for us to do our jobs, we need the conditions for this to happen.
UN officials accused the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad of making it nearly impossible for aid convoys to move around and get access to people in dire need. They say bureaucratic red tape is holding up the visas needed to deliver humanitarian aid. If this hurdle was overcome and they were granted access, they say 3 UN convoys could be dispatched each week. This would enable them to reach more than 700,000 people in besieged and hard-to-reach areas in the next 2 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There's another battle brewing in Washington, this time regarding another memo. Now, last week, the president declassified a 3.5-page memo written by staffers on the Republican House Intelligence Committee that they said showed how the current investigation into Russian collusion was based on a farce. Democrats on the committee have their own memo countering the GOP's effort, and the committee has sent that memo to the White House as well for the president's okay to declassify that one. There's just one thing. There's no guarantee that Mr. Trump will release the Democrats' interpretation of intelligence. We have more now from VOA's Bill Gallo at the White House.
Democrats say they're just setting the record straight.
We think this will help inform the public of the many distortions and inaccuracies in the majority memo.
The push to release the Democratic memo is in response to a Republican memo released last week accusing the FBI of using research funded by the Hillary Clinton campaign as justification for spying on Trump campaign advisor Carter Page and his links to Russia.
Oh, but did we catch them in the act or what? You know what I'm talking about. Oh, did we catch them in the act? They are very embarrassed. They never thought they were going to get caught. We caught them.
Trump argues the memo vindicates him of wrongdoing in the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. But special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation continues. And Democrats, and even many Republicans, say Mueller's investigation was based on more than just opposition research.
Let me tell you what the memo is not.
Please.
The memo is not a rebuke of Bob Mueller's investigation. Bob Mueller should be allowed to turn over every rock, pursue every lead to completion.
Before the Democrats' memo is released, it must first be reviewed by Trump. White House officials are hinting, but not guaranteeing, that he'll release it. A White House spokesman says Trump may also support a new investigation of the FBI's conduct. Bill Gallo, VOA News, The White House.
This is Science in a Minute.
No doubt you've heard about extrasolar or exoplanets, planets that were discovered orbiting a star outside of our own solar system. Nearly 3,000 of these planets have been confirmed so far, with many more candidate planets waiting to be verified. However, these planets have all been discovered within our own Milky Way galaxy. An astrophysics team from the University of Oklahoma has taken the search for planets beyond our own solar system a step further. Using gravitational lensing, a technique predicted by Einstein in his 1915 General Theory of Relativity, they have discovered the first planets to be found outside of the Milky Way, or extragalactic planets. Located in a galaxy 3.8 billion light-years from Earth, the scientists say the planets they found range in mass from that of the Moon to Jupiter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome back to VOA's International Edition. North Korea's participation in the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics Games, set to begin this week, has brought about a temporary pause in its nuclear and missile tests. For host country and neighbor South Korea, these peaceful developments validate its support for greater engagement to peacefully resolve the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. The United States, however, remains skeptical of the North's charm offensive that it sees as an attempt to undermine international support for tough economic sanctions. VOA's Brian Padden has that story from Seoul.
At the Pyeongchang Olympics, North and South Korea will march together under a special unified flag during the opening ceremonies. They will also field a unified women's ice hockey team. An all-female North Korean cheering squad known as its Army of Beauties will be on hand to support athletes from both countries, and the North Korean Samjeon Band Orchestra and other artists will perform in both the Pyeongchang region and Seoul. For South Korean President Moon Jae-in, this inter-Korean Olympic cooperation is part of a broader diplomatic initiative to peacefully resolve the North Korean nuclear standoff.
We have to lead North Korea into a dialogue of denuclearization as well, which will also improve inter-Korean relationships.
However, in South Korea, there is increasing opposition to Moon's Olympic engagement that conservatives see as unilateral concessions to the repressive North. The U.S. also views the North's Olympic cooperation as an attempt to improve its threatening image and weaken international support for tough international sanctions.
I think this is a distraction. I think this is doing what North Korea has always done, which is when things get hot, start talking.
U.S. President Donald Trump has pushed for a maximum pressure policy emphasizing tougher economic sanctions and possible military action to stop the North from developing long-range nuclear missiles that can target the U.S. mainland. But North Korean leader Kim Jong-un remains unwilling to even talk about halting his country's nuclear program. To underscore its defiant stance, North Korea is expected to hold a massive military parade on the day before the Olympics opening ceremony that may show off the long-range missiles it has been testing. President Trump was noncommittal when recently asked about the prospects for peace after the Olympics.
We're going to find out how it goes, but we think the Olympics will go very nicely, and after that, who knows? We'll find out. We're going to find out pretty soon, I suspect.
The U.S. and South Korea have suspended joint military exercises for the Olympics, but indicated they would resume soon after the Games, despite a North Korean demand to further suspend the drills to support improving inter-Korean relations. And there is increasing talk in Washington about launching a bloody-nose limited military strike in response to the next North Korean provocation, despite the risk it could spark a deadly conflict in the region. Brian Padden, VOA News Seoul.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Finally today, the 52nd annual Super Bowl, that frenzy of American football, cheesy nachos, and even cheesier commercials, is now in the record books. It was a record-breaking game to boot, more total passing yardage than any championship game, and a first-ever Super Bowl win for the Philadelphia Eagles, or Eagles if you live in Philly. What wasn't so record-breaking was the halftime performance by singer and actor Justin Timberlake. Now, there was a lot of hype that his performance was going to be high on the fizz factor, but in the end, it was more like fizzle. Larry London, host of VOA's Border Crossings pop music program, sat down with our colleague Sarah Williams to discuss all things Timberlake.
Let's talk about Justin Timberlake and his brand new album, which just came out a week ago, and his brand new song, and his Super Bowl performance. Justin Timberlake, who began on Star Search back in the 80s when it was hosted by Ed McMahon and then made his way up to the Disney Mickey Mouseketeer Club when he was a member of that as a teenager. Then, of course, with NSYNC and all the big hits he had. Now, Justin is a big solo act. He's a movie actor as well as a songwriter and a musician and a father, too, to a baby that's almost two now, Silas Randall, married to actress Jessica Biel. But it was Justin Timberlake center stage at the Super Bowl that's caused a lot of controversy. First of all, his performance on Super Bowl Sunday has, rated his performance as number 10 on the Super Bowl lists. Last year, they had 111 million people watching. This year, it was down to 103 million. So the Super Bowl viewership for his performance at halftime took a little hit. He was on stage. It was interesting. I don't know if you had a chance to see the Super Bowl.
I did see some of it.
He started underground and made his way out into the stadium and danced with the people. Some people are calling it underwhelming, that it really didn't deliver on the promise of special, unique, wow factor, memorable moments. I mean, he just came out and he just did Justin, and he danced in the crowd and danced on the stage with his background dancers. He sang an array of his hits back with solo albums. His last solo album was the 2020 Experience a number of years ago. An artist does take a risk when they take some time off, as Justin's done. His new album is called Man of the Woods. Let's check out the new single called Filthy. Here's Justin Timberlake. Put your filthy hands all over me. No, this ain't clean.
What you gonna do with all that meat? Well, Larry, among the criticisms, I believe, it was also because he did like a Prince number, a tribute to Prince, because
yes.
Minneapolis is Prince's hometown.
He said that he had to do it. He felt kind of endeared to Prince. He has proclaimed that Prince was an icon, an idol, an influence on his career, although there's some that say that Prince didn't care for Justin Timberlake's music, and they felt it was inappropriate, and Justin had even rented out to Paisley Park, Prince's home, to have a listening party for his album prior to the Super Bowl. So a lot of people were rubbed the wrong way by some of the things that Justin did. It's a good thing that Justin did not do what he initially planned to do, which was to have a hologram of Prince perform with him. Instead, he opted for having images of Prince portrayed up on a big giant screen, which was kind of a cloth blowing in the wind. But nonetheless, he sang If I Would Die for You, which is a big Prince hit. I Would Die for You. And it wasn't anything that people would walk away. I found Pink's performance of the national anthem before the game to be more of a wow factor to me than watching Justin sing some of the old songs that I've heard him sing so many times before. So it just kind of was underwhelming. But the new song is kind of back. It's a retro sounding song, and it captures some of the 80s music from like the guys in New Edition and things like that. It's very 80-esque, filthy, and so it's typical Justin Timberlake. We'll wait and see how the rest of the album sounds. He calls this album Americana and folk. You wouldn't know it from the first song, Filthy, that's for sure. But we'll wait and see how the rest of it turns out for Justin Timberlake.
And when is the full album going to be released?
It was released last week. It was released on February 2nd, 2 days before the Super Bowl. So everybody got a chance to get the album. It's just kind of taking root now. The first song is Filthy. He hasn't released any more singles. He is going to go out on a world tour, I'm sure, to support the album as well.
Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Meh, I like the old Justin. Well, many thanks for joining us on International Edition on The Voice of America today. Up next, all the latest world news, so stay tuned for that. For all of us in Studio 25, Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm Doug Bernard. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump recently hosted a group of North Koreans who risked all to flee the brutal North Korean regime. Facing imprisonment for himself and his family, university professor Dr. Hyun fled North Korea in 2004. Dr. Hyun said he had never experienced the outside world and was very nervous because the North Korean regime and North Korea was all he knew. When Dr. Hyun got to South Korea, he said, "I could say freely whatever I thought, which one could not do in North Korea. So I'm really living a new life that I had not imagined before." Jung Kwang-il was sent to the infamous Yeouk prison camp for 3 years for alleged espionage. He fled to South Korea and now heads up an organization called No Chain, which tries to stop the abuse of political prisoners in North Korea and works to get information into North Korea. He personally translated President Trump's State of the Union address and sent it into North Korea for the people to see. Kim Young-soon was also sent to Yeouk prison camp, a place where rape, murder, torture, and even cannibalism are not uncommon, all because she learned the secrets of the ruling family. The notoriously brutal camp claimed the lives of most of her family and left her young son severely disabled. She fled North Korea in 2001. Author and defector Hyun-soo Lee says escaping from North Korea is more like leaving another universe than another country. "After I escaped to China," she added, "I escaped an arranged marriage when I was 19, and I also escaped a brothel, and eventually I was arrested by the Chinese police, but narrowly avoided being repatriated back to North Korea because of my Chinese language abilities." Repatriated North Korean defectors face torture and imprisonment and horrifying public executions even today. Many North Korean defectors carry poisons with them in case they are caught in China on their way to freedom in South Korea. "These defectors are just great people that have suffered incredibly," said President Trump. "That's why the United States will continue to expose the brutal regime of Kim Jong-un for the barbaric way it treats its people."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.